Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and for those of you who may have just joined us, my guest is Kadri Leek, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and a guest who's been on this podcast before. Welcome, Kadri.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. It's great to speak to you again. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has compared himself in the past to some people you might think would be about as unlike him as one could get. Specifically, and I'd say inexplicably, he suggested he's on the same level as the late nonviolent anti-colonial resistance leader Mahatma Gandhi. Well, both of them studied law, so there's that. But on Thursday, Putin likened himself to Peter the First, the Tsar known in the West more often as Peter the Great, and the one who was the founder of Putin's hometown, St. Petersburg. This was on the 350th anniversary of Peter's birth, and Putin drew the comparison in the context of the war in Ukraine, though he did not mention it directly. He claimed that Peter, quote, returned, unquote, territory that was rightfully Russia's and strengthened Russia in the process. And he suggested that he's doing the same in the war he's unleashed against Ukraine, which has in fact, of course, been an independent country, just like Russia, since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Now, many people have interpreted Putin's remarks as kind of an admission that whatever other goals or reasons he has cited for his decision to launch a large-scale invasion of Ukraine in February, his real aim or his main aim is simply to seize land, a land grab. Kadri, how do you interpret Putin's Peter the Great comparison? And I'll also ask, is it important or just another kind of piece of propaganda? Do you think it will have any practical effect on the course of the war in Ukraine? Carl Bildt, the former Swedish prime minister, said that Putin's remarks were a recipe for years of war.
Yes, thank you, Steve. These are all good questions. I'll try to unpack it a little bit. I think it is by now fair to say that this war is about land grab. It has become about that. Maybe it was about it to start with, because you know, when we were all following the negotiations between Russia and various Western institutions and the United States in December, early this year, then I thought that of the things that Russia could want from the West, very many were available through that diplomatic path. Definitely security talks about arms control that was explicitly offered, neutral status for Ukraine that was emerging. So Russia could have got a lot what they wanted. Also, we like it or not, but I think the rearrangement of European security order was in the cards as well. The West had already started discussing these things with Putin in different paradigms. But the one thing that was never available through diplomatic path was land grabs. Dismemberment of Ukraine, incorporation of eastern parts or whichever parts into Russia. So the question back then to me was, what does Putin actually want? If really he prioritizes his land over everything else, then these negotiations are a dead end. Back then I didn't think so, because Putin had always had a significant element of rationality in his wishes and planning, and I did not think he was ready to sacrifice all other Russia's interests, or at least risk with them in a significant manner to get a chunk of Ukraine. But he did exactly that. Whether it was design or accident, we also don't know for now. We don't know whether he expected annexing parts of Ukraine to be easy and the West to forgive it soon, or did he really understand that ahead of him was a huge bloody war with huge sanctions, and he still thought that risk was worth taking? We don't answer to that question right now. I hope we live until the archives open and we can maybe see some evidence of it. But all that was to say that I think it is about land grab. But it depends. Still, the question is, you know, what kind of land and why? My inclination is to think that Ukraine for Putin is special. And there seems to be a significant religious and historical motivation to his war. I think it's sort of a little bit like the Crusader-style war. Like Crusaders were trying to liberate the tomb of Jesus. Putin is trying to, as he would say, liberate the birthplace of Russian statehood, which happens to be Kiev. So hence the whole thing. Question is whether he would continue the same crusade in other lands outside Ukraine, or how far even in Ukraine he intends to go. Many Russian interlocutors have said that, you know, we are not interested in Lviv. Not that this makes things any better, but so I do not know if what we are dealing with is conscious plan by the Kremlin to really to retake not just all lands of the former Soviet Union, but or maybe especially the lands of the Tsarist Russia, and that would have implications also for Baltic states, but also to Finland, that was never part of the Soviet Union. Or is it still overwhelmingly about Ukraine? Yet again, not that this makes it any better, because there are multiple ways how this war can spill over from Ukraine. It could spill into Moldova. Poland is in the neighborhood and is helping Ukraine actively. I see that also some other countries that have been actively equipping Ukraine with arms, etc., are worried if at one point their involvement does not make them direct target for Russia. So spillover options are definitely there, but there is a slight difference whether we speak about sort of conscious design to grab land or spillover. And of course it is an extremely archaic foreign policy agenda. I cannot stop wondering about that. I mean, to my eyes, Russia was emerging as sort of modern state that was not democratic, not nice in that way, didn't share many of that of soft, nice values that we see in the West, but that was still sort of managing to set its goals to match the ends and means, and sort of finding its feet in the post-imperial environment. And now suddenly this war has sort of thrown them back really into totally archaic agenda. And the tragic thing for me is, of course, that it's really hard to see how people who come after Putin will get out of it. I'm afraid that if his aim was to saddle the future generations with Ukraine, with a need to keep the country, to manage that territory somehow, then he may well have succeeded, because even the people who were always against that war, should they come to power, it will be quite hard.
I think we may have lost contact with Kadri. Sorry, are you there?
Sorry, yes, I'm here. Please say great. It again. Yeah, it cut off for a second.
Yeah, no problem. Go ahead.
Where did you lose me?
Just the idea that future generations post-Putin may be saddled with this sort of idea that they have to, that Russia has to control Ukraine.
Yes. Yes, basically that's where I finished while you didn't hear me. That it's really hard to imagine that leaders who come after Putin, and there will be rows, it will be very hard for them, even if they were against the war, either passionately or reluctantly. Nonetheless, it will be quite hard for them to undo the war. And in that respect, I think the end of this war, the outcome on the battlefield, is important in all sorts of ways. But also, I think it'll have a decisive link to West's future relationship with Russia. Because if Russia ends up occupying huge chunks of Ukrainian land, then that will always be a conflict that is impossible to really overcome. I don't see any agreement there. I don't see the West legitimizing it. I think it's very hard for Russia to give it away. So maybe paradoxically, but in this case, I think Russia's defeat on the battlefield will actually help a better relationship with the West in the future, regardless of the kind of leadership that emerges in Russia. But that will just sort of eliminate one inevitable conflict question or make it smaller in size.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it seems like, just to build on a few of your points or comment, it seems like the kind of the end of the war is not in sight, but then depending on how it ends or how it kind of settles or what the result is, then the problems, the huge, obviously gigantic problems that it has caused, are going to be with us for decades or more. So that's obviously a very disturbing thought. What, another thing you mentioned that I would just note, the idea of going further, Poland and other countries, there's been some talk about an article on the Russian state news agency RIA from today or yesterday, I believe, kind of claiming, baselessly claiming that Poland is in the midst of a big operation to kind of take control over Ukraine and the rest of Central Europe. And this is the kind of thing that that's out there in terms of the Russian propaganda that's kind of making excuses, I guess, for whatever happens in this war. And you also mentioned, another thing, the idea that this, there's a lot of talk about to what year has Putin kind of thrown Russia back, to the 80s, the 90s, the 80s, the 70s. But as you point out, I mean, in terms of foreign policy and what he's done, it's really kind of the, and I saw this elsewhere as well, it's kind of the archaic foreign policy. And also you mentioned this I find quite, fascinating. It's obviously horrifying, but the idea that Russia was kind of one of the reasons few people predicted that until the last days, really, until some of his darkest kind of comments in February, one reason that few people predicted that Russia would actually go ahead with the invasion was that it seemed like it could get not everything it was demanding, but a lot of the things that you could presumably would actually want in terms of rearrangement of European security, possibly. And that was just kind of thrown away. And, as you say, I think, for a while it seemed like the negotiations that were held before the invasion, they could have been meaningful. But in the end, it turns out that maybe there was no hope for them in the first place. And we may never know. We may know some of it, as you mentioned, when archives open long after this is over. So thanks for those points. The other question I'd like to ask, it's sort of related. It's about the course of the war and the role of the West. Some Putin's comments came at a time when things are kind of changing in terms of the situation in the war on the battlefield. Several weeks ago, it started to seem as if Ukraine had a pretty good chance of a decent chance of driving Russian forces out of the country, or at least out of mainland Ukraine. And people were starting to talk about something that they hadn't really before, which was Ukraine, the prospect of Ukraine winning the war after several major setbacks for Russia in the first days, weeks, and really the first couple months. And there's still setbacks for Russia, but now many observers are saying the kind of Ukraine driving Russian forces out seems less likely than it did quite recently, and many are predicting the war will continue for months or for years. Kadri, what's your thinking on this? And to what degree does the situation in the coming weeks and months depend on the actions of the West? I mean, you mentioned that that relations between Russia and the West will depend largely for a long time on the outcome of the war. But so how much do you think depends on the actions of the West in terms of, I guess, weapons deliveries and the response to Ukraine's bid to join the European Union and so forth?
Thanks. Yes, well, this question carries a risk of making me overstep the boundaries of my competence, which I will try to avoid. But what I understand from people who know military matters better than me, well, that was to be expected because Ukraine had strengths in the early weeks of the war when Russia tried to do something stupid, to send these long columns long ahead from supply lines. They were vulnerable. They were easy to attack for Ukrainians. Ukraine also had more supplies in the early weeks. So I guess we got that impression of success from those early months when Ukraine didn't fall as many expected. It resisted bravely, so that Russians were forced to rethink their game plan. And to be completely honest, it wasn't exactly that Ukraine drove Russians out. Russians left because they decided to focus on the battlefields in Donbass. They weren't exactly kicked out, but they of course had to leave because they had done a stupid blunder. That game plan was not viable. But I think it was always obvious to military analysts that once it gets down to the classical war of attrition that we are not seeing now, it will be extremely hard for both sides, these merciless city battles. And this will erode some of the advantages Ukraine had early on. I hope they still have some advantages over Russia. I mean, in city battles, they say that the defender always has the edge. I hope that is the case, but right now, really, I mean, Ukraine faces off Russia's massive firepower, and that is truly hard. So in that situation, I think Western arms deliveries are really quite critical, and I would hope that the West can give Ukraine more and sooner. Whether that'll help to turn the tide entirely, I do not know, but it might come closer to the point when both armies are exhausted so that some sort of ceasefire inevitably follows. And that is, I think, probably where it could end based on what we are seeing now. it's probably unlikely that Russia will, but Ukraine will manage to drive Russia out of eastern Ukraine. It's also questionable how big advances Russians can have, because also their army is not unlimited. I mean, if you listen to what military analysts say, Russia doesn't have a good conscription system that would be a solution. Plus, they don't want to do total mobilization anyway. So Russia's manpower is probably going to be exhausted, depleted at one point. And then I guess we could see a ceasefire. To make that ceasefire to be more in Ukraine's terms than Russia's, I think weapons deliveries are important, even if they are not a game changer, and there are difficulties. Not everything can be taken into use by Ukrainians easily, etc., etc. We all know what the obstacles are, nonetheless, and they are really fairly urgent. The other actions, such as candidate status in the European Union, that, to be honest, that would be a big symbolic gesture of support. It would probably matter in that context. It would hopefully boost morale, etc. But I don't see it having any immediate effects on the battlefield. Either way, I don't also think it will make Russia more aggressive. Some people have tried to argue that it is the European Union membership that actually irritates Russia, because Russia started intervening in 2013 after Ukraine decided to sign DCFTA with the European Union. So that this matters. I think we are beyond the point where these things mattered. Russia has gone all out in Ukraine, and EU membership does not change their plans for better or worse. And it doesn't change many things in the battlefield. But of course, I would hope that the European Union would approach that matter responsibly. What I also would not want to see is Ukraine promised a candidate status now, and then it being delayed, like was the case with Turkey, that caused huge disappointment and in the end played a role in making Turkey-Europe relations strange as they are now. So this is nonetheless, even though it doesn't have immediate impact on the battlefield, that is a very serious decision that one should think through and really mean it if we go for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like kind of very sound advice. And interesting your point that at this point, an invitation for Ukraine is not likely to make Russia more aggressive. As you mentioned, in a way, this whole thing started at the war that's been going on in eastern Ukraine in the Donbass for a little more than 8 years. Started with the plans by Ukraine when it was President Yanukovych to sign the trade agreement with the EU. And Russia and Putin particularly put a great deal of pressure on him not to do so, and that worked. But then the Maidan protest movement occurred, and that changed things. And then after Yanukovych fled, Russia began, Russia seized Crimea and fomented the separatism, and essentially leading to the war in the Donbass. So, that was a big factor at the time, the EU. But as you say, and of course, one of the pretexts, or one of the reasons that Russia and Putin have cited for what they're doing now, is the idea that can't let Ukraine join NATO. But that was also kind of something that is, maybe been sort of subsumed into the whole, it's sort of bigger than that now. Russia's gone beyond kind of any specific goals like that of preventing Ukraine from joining the EU or joining NATO. As you said, kind of going back to archaic foreign policy. So we'll see what happens with that. I believe there's a decision fairly soon on the EU, at least a preliminary decisions coming up. So I'd like to open this up to questions. If anyone has any questions, you can, I've said how you can ask the questions. Let me see if there are any. Okay, I'll just wait a little bit longer if anyone...
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you. Thanks for the discussion. Thanks for the panel. Just a short comment and a question. First of all, Crimea wasn't seized because it wasn't lying there to be picked up. It was occupied by Russia, not even annexed. Occupied. Russia didn't foment separatism because there was no separatist movement to begin. Russia injected special forces and started the war in Donbass by Russian military in 2014, despite what Russian propaganda says. That said, it's also peculiar how we try to figure out what Russia's aims are. Well, Putin already said what the aims are. It's to destroy Ukrainian nation, essentially subjugate, and right now they are perpetrating genocide. So we can be clear on that. That has been officially stated by Putin. That said, the question, the only question that remains, how long will we wait for Western governments, and if not for the governments, for Western societies and civic societies to drag their feet in order to give a nudge to their governments to deliver weapons to Ukraine? Because what we are witnessing is a genocide of Ukrainian nation happening in real life. So that's the question, the only question.
Yes, well, thank you for the question, despite its nature. And I agree with the assessment that there was no separatism in eastern Ukraine at that time. It was very obvious that after the Maidan revolution, the eastern Ukrainian regions were ready to adapt to the new reality. You could see that if you followed news in those days. And then Russians, not even special forces, but people like Igor Kirkin, the foreign policy entrepreneurs or fanatics started turning up, and that's what made that war and ensuing stalemate possible. I entirely agree. It wasn't Ukrainian-born division at all. And if I had any doubts, I traveled through the full old contact line in 2016 from Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Severodonetsk down to Mariupol. So everything I needed to know about eastern Ukraine, that trip told me. These people were all tired of war and all considered it to be imported. As to weapons deliveries, well, I think European public is fairly emotional. Here in Germany, I can see that also my German colleagues and local media are impatient because they don't see Germany delivering weapons fast enough. But of course, one needs to understand that countries have their own security to consider. And as I said, countries that have been more active in delivering weapons are now asking where do they cross the point that makes them either targets to Russia or or still, you know, Russia to consider them directly involved. And these sentiments you can also see if you talk with people in sort of more hawkish countries who have delivered quite a lot and significantly powerful weapon systems. So I think we also need to understand that countries have their own security interests to mind, and it's fairly hard to make that assessment. Of course, everyone wants Ukraine to have upper hand and Russia to lose and to learn a lesson. But if you think that
I have a follow-up, sorry. Isn't this in European countries' security interest to actually stop the war in Ukraine? Because Russia is interested to further project. So eventually, at this point, Ukraine is carrying the burden of war for you. It's quite hypocrite to claim that one's security interests are to basically languish and drag feet, because right now your security interests are in Ukraine.
That's not really a question.
Yeah, that is your assessment. And I think we all need to sort of have enough patience to understand that countries have different assessments of Russia's intentions, of how her own security becomes endangered, etc. I don't think it makes sense to sort of assume that our assessment is the only correct one and everyone who doesn't share it is a hypocrite. These things need to be stuff debated. Thankfully, we have organizations such as NATO that is not going to confront Russia head on, but at least it's a good platform where Western countries can share information, intelligence assessments, etc. But that is a complicated matter for countries. So I see very many people who are very emotional and very impatient. I understand that. It's hard not to be when you see what is happening in Ukraine. But I just wish to remind us that the governments that are, we might think, dragging their feet are not doing so because of evil intentions or laziness or comfort or whatnot. Their thinking, their concerns, their considerations, and sometimes indeed sort of bureaucratic hurdles behind it. And it is not so easy. It should be done. I agree with that.
I agree with that statement. The only final question is, considering that the genocide is happening, so how many more lives have to be lost? Right now it's tens of thousands. Will we wait until it's hundreds of thousands or millions until we make a move? Or it's just a different country sounds far away and we can just enjoy our cozy, you know, cozy lifestyle in the middle of Europe until Ukrainians can carry the burden of war and suffer. So it's an open-ended question, of course, but...
Right, I mean, how long will we wait, or how long will Western countries wait, or what will they do? Not really a question for someone analyzing the situation. You're asking a question that's rhetorical, I guess. But I really thank Kadri for her answers to the questions you did ask. Are there any other questions? I'd like to move on. Anyone else have any questions?
We have scared them all off.
Sorry, was somebody raising their hand, Rosalie? Perhaps not. I just want to say about that exchange. Just, you know, I think Kadri did say, you know, respond to the question that I asked about how important is, you know, is our Western actions, and she mentioned, you know, that weapons, you know, are crucial, I believe was the word, or critical and very important. So, you know, that's part of the answer to, I think, what you were asking. So, just a few more moments, but if no other questions, I'll and wrap it up here. Okay, let's do that. Thanks very much, everyone, for joining us. And Kadri, thanks very much for your excellent insights.
Thank you.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Kadri Leek, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And my name is Steve Gutterman, Editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia, and my newsletter, The Week in Russia, will appear on June 24th, after 1 week's hiatus. Thanks very much for listening.